high near 80, and Monday night, partly cloudy with low around 60.
Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here Sunday, June 3rd, 2012, in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Inequality, of course, is an issue most Americans are very well aware of, and it's grown in prominence in the past few years. Likewise, financialization and financial crises, another issue we're living with consequences with to this day. Our guest today is an economist who will be talking about their connection, financial instability, inequality, and what a dubious marriage it has become for the American people and people around the world. Our guest, James Galbraith, joining us. But first, let's go to NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. George Zimmerman is back in a Florida jail. He's the neighborhood watch volunteer charged with the shooting death of unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin in a gated community near Orlando earlier this year. Zimmerman claimed self-defense and had been free on bail. Last week, the judge revoked the bail, saying that Zimmerman and his wife had lied about their finances during the bond hearing. They claimed they had limited funds. Zimmerman's lawyer says that he surrendered himself a short time ago. The U.S. is pressing Russia to help other nations bring change to Syria. International outrage has been mounting after last month's massacre in Hula that killed more than 100 people, including many children. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says she's been speaking by phone with her Russian counterpart and insisting that more must be done.
We all have to intensify our efforts to achieve a political transition, and Russia has to be at the table helping that to occur.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad today denied his government was responsible for the killings in Hula. In a speech to the parliament, he blamed foreign-backed terrorists and extremists. It was quite a sight in London today. Queen Elizabeth boarded her royal barge and sailed the River Thames, accompanied by 1,000 boats. Hundreds of thousands of people watched and cheered from the riverbanks. The flotilla was part of celebrations to mark the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, 60 years on the throne. Tomorrow, a concert will be held outside Buckingham Palace, with performances by Paul McCartney and Elton John. British entertainer Richard Dawson has died. His son says he died last night at a Los Angeles hospital of complications from esophageal cancer. Dawson played a wisecracking POW in Hogan's Heroes and was the host of the game show Family Feud. Richard Dawson was 79. A huge wildfire continues to rage in southwestern New Mexico. It's now the largest active blaze in the nation and has scorched nearly 390 square miles. It's about 17% contained. Elaine Baumgartel reports from member station KUNM. Officials are employing multiple firefighting strategies.
The lightning-sparked blaze is still growing, and firefighters are using bulldozed lanes, existing roads, and natural barriers like streams and rivers as fire lines. Fire Information Officer Lee Bentley says crews are also working out beyond the fire perimeter to backburn bone-dry grasses and dead trees.
Because you have to fight flame with flame a lot of times, and once there's no more fuel, it goes out.
Residents who were evacuated from the small community of Mogollon found out this weekend they'll be allowed to return to their homes on Monday as fire crews have mopped up operations there. For NPR News, I'm Elaine Baumgartel in Albuquerque.
This is NPR News from Washington. A passenger plane crashed into an apartment building in Lagos, Nigeria today. Officials say it went down just after takeoff in clear weather. They couldn't provide details of any casualties. The Associated Press reports that firefighters pulled one body from the heavily damaged building. Also in Nigeria today, a man drove a car into a church compound in the northern part of the country and blew it up. At least 8 people were killed and dozens were wounded. No one has claimed responsibility, but suspicion fell in a radical Islamist sect that frequently targets Christians. Consumer advocate and Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Warren has received the largest margin ever of delegates at the Massachusetts Democratic Convention. Her win knocks out a potential primary challenger. Lynn Joliker of member station WBUR reports Warren will now focus on her Republican opponent, incumbent Senator Scott Brown.
And now, I've got just one thing to say. I'm ready.
With Springsteen's The Rising booming, Elizabeth Warren thanked delegates for giving her a huge endorsement, almost 96% of the vote. She pledged to take on Wall Street, Big Oil, and Scott Brown, then told a group of supporters and media her big win within the party was not about her.
This is really about all the people who really understand that America's families have been hammered. They understand that Washington is not working for them.
Warren said she's anxious and ready to debate Brown. For NPR News, I'm Lynn Joliker in Boston.
In hockey, the LA Kings beat the New Jersey Devils last night. They now lead the Stanley Cup playoffs 2-0. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Valvoline, maker of Next Gen Motor Oil, engine protection with oil made from 50% recycled stock. Learn more at Valvoline.com.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. And our guest today, James Galbraith, is a professor at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, an economist and an author of numerous books, including the outstanding book, The Predator State, and a new book, which we'll be talking about today, Inequality and Instability, published by Oxford University Press. Professor Galbraith, welcome to Media Matters.
Good to be with you.
Well, before we get into your book, I would like to start, since we have the privilege of having an economist on the air, to talk about the news that's going on that I think a lot of my listeners are concerned about and everyone's concerned about. Both the United States economy, the recent data suggests the recovery is not going especially well. And the news from Europe is also disconcerting, that the European economies are having trouble and that their currency regime is in crisis. And then China, which has been sort of the boomer of global capitalism or the global economy, is having its problems too. And I was just wondering if you could give me your assessment of where we're at, because I think this will probably lead into your book.
Well, the U.S. situation is certainly no surprise to me. I have been saying since the start of this debacle that the phrase recovery was kind of an instinctive reflex word, not a description of what was actually going to happen. We faced effectively the meltdown of the financial sector and, to a very substantial degree, the insolvency of the American middle class as people went underwater, upside down on their mortgages. And in that situation, the notion that there's going to be strong growth is that would bring us out of this in any quick, short period was not plausible from the beginning. Economists, I think, did not analyze this situation reflectively. They were using their models and the statistical record of the post-war period rather than common sense. In the European situation, we have the unfolding of a real tragedy of institutional misdesign, of the creation of a European Union that did not have effective stabilizing institutions. So they're actually facing something substantially worse than what we're facing here. Here we have the prospect of slow growth and stagnation, and the lost opportunity to return to where to a more prosperous economy. In Europe, in parts of Europe, they're facing panic, the possibility of bank runs, the possibility that the entire currency union will come apart, which would be create exceptionally difficult circumstances for millions of people.
And then there's China, which is a country I think in your writing you've written about with more authority than most American economists. It has been a boom economy for the last 20 years, and it's sort of, people were hoping it would hold up the, drag the rest of the economy along after it. And now there are signs that it might not be able to continue in that function.
Well, it was always a bit silly to expect China to hold up the manufacturing economies of the rest of the world, because China is a powerful manufacturing economy itself and is not going to be importing goods and services apart from machinery and such, from the rich countries of the world. So when China booms, that has been very good for commodity producers, very good for Latin America, very good for Australia, but not great significance for the United States or Europe. What's going on in China, I'm going to refrain from pronouncing on because I don't feel like I have a great authority on it at the moment.
Well, let's talk just quickly again about the nature of the political debates about our economy in the presidential election, which is really the only race where the economy gets sustained attention in a meaningful way by people who will be in a position to implement policies directly. And, I assume you're following the political race. And,
yes.
What's your take on, the positions of the two respective major party candidates, President Obama and Mitt Romney? Are there distinct differences, is there more agreement than disagreement? I mean, how good of a job do they have of representing the range of options before us just to get the economy in better shape?
Well, the president took a gamble earlier this year by basically keying his reelection to the notion that the optimists would finally be right and that there was an ongoing recovery that would mature over the summer. It doesn't look like that was a very sensible gamble, and it does suggest to me that the president needs new economists, or at least if his economists have been warning him against that kind of sophomoric optimism, he should have been paying attention to them. In Governor Romney's case, it's hard to decide what to say because there really isn't an economic policy there other than a kind of magical notion that if you changed the personnel at the White House that the American economy would respond to that. There's no reason to believe that that's the case. There, we are looking at a world in which there is, from neither party, is offering a serious response to the underlying challenges that the American economy faces, which include the need to strengthen rather than weaken Social Security and the other social protections that we have, include the need to provide jobs, the need to deal with the foreclosure debacle, and the need to deal with energy and the environment. And I just list these issues, you can see that, in fact, nobody's talking about them. When they do talk about the economy, they talk in abstract terms about growth and maybe a little bit about deficits and debt and issues that over which they have no influence. And if they did deal with them, they would probably end up doing more harm than good.
You know, Professor Galbraith, one thing I know that drives my guest who'll be on next week, Paul Krugman, insane, and he repeatedly writes about it, is how...
Well, Paul's perfectly sane.
No, he drives him insane. is the claim that if we lower taxes on wealthy people, that will stimulate the economy and create jobs, and that sort of and cut back on social programs like Social Security and to balance the budget and get rid of the threat of ongoing deficits, that too will improve the economy. And that goes largely unchallenged in our political discourse, doesn't it?
Yes, there is a kind of enforced consensus thinking on the subject, which is you can understand why it's very important that nobody challenge this reasoning, because it's nonsense. It would fall apart if it were seriously challenged. But let's just take one aspect of the complex of issues you raised, which is this notion that the United States government's deficit poses a tremendous threat to our economic recovery. What is our economic conditions? What exactly is the nature of that threat? Robert Rubin, a reputable individual, or allegedly reputable individual, served as Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, extremely influential, had a piece in the Wall Street Journal, I believe, a couple of days ago, in which he said that the deficits were crowding out private investment. Does anybody seriously think this? Is it possible to think that the reason private businesses are not investing in this country, that they're not building houses, is anything other than the fact that there's no way to sell them? If they're not investing in plant and equipment, it's because they don't expect the markets to be there? Does anybody seriously think that the problem that they face is that they're they're being out-competed for funds by the federal government.
Yeah, if I can just interject here, because for the sake of our listeners, this, the crowded out argument, which goes back many decades, was predicated on the idea that government borrowing was going to drive up interest rates and soak up available capital.
Exactly so.
And interest rates now are virtually zero for business.
For the government, they're virtually zero, yes. This is not the problem faced by the capital markets. So it's, you know, the notion, it's an argument which was based upon the assumption that the economy always operates at full employment. But you can pick up the morning paper and realize, or just walk out on the street corner and realize the economy is not functioning at full employment. You know, why even a reputable newspaper publishes drivel like that is an interesting question.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Professor James Galbraith from the University of Texas, the Lyndon Baine Johnson School of Public Policy there. He's the author of numerous books, including The Predator State, one of my favorite books of the last decade, and also a brand new book published by Oxford University Press titled Inequality and Instability, which we'll be talking about during the course of today's show. We'll be taking telephone calls here at WILL at 217-333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. As I suspect you've already detected, Professor Galbraith is, I think, equipped to respond intelligently to most any question on political economy and current economic issues. Let's talk about your book now, if we can, James Galbraith. And let's, you know, what's the point of the book? What's it based on? And what's your core argument?
The book reflects about 15 years, actually, of work on the problem of economic inequality and presents evidence about what has happened in the entire world, not just the United States, over 40 years or so of the historical record. So it does a lot to add to what was known previously about the behavior of the economy of the world as a whole. At least in my view, it does. What does it show? It shows that economic inequality is something which has a common pattern all throughout the world, very closely related to the way in which the world economy is influenced by finance, by the financial sector, and by the governance of finance. And in particular, vast increase of inequality, which occurred all around the world in a kind of common great movement, occurred from 1980 to 2000 as a result of the debt crises and rolling waves of economic distress that went around the world at that time. The basic inference I draw from this is that economic inequality is a kind of measure of stress or instability in the economy, much more than it is a measure of actual distress on the part of you know, economic actors or participants in the short run. So it is possible, and it happened in the United States, for example, in the late 1990s, economic inequality went up enormously in the information technology boom. But at least while it was going on, there were a lot of jobs and people were doing reasonably well. The problem and what the inequality indicators basically tell you or should have told you was that it couldn't last. And I think that's a pretty good way to read the measures of inequality that we have in the United States and around the world.
And one of the arguments you make, Professor Galbraith, that I think, you know, it's almost in your subtitle, in fact, or it's deep in the book, is, it's in the title, Instability, which is that inequality promotes crises in capitalism, that it's bad for a functioning capitalist economy. Is that a fair way to put it?
Let me try a slightly different phrasing.
Okay.
I've been working on a new metaphor, which isn't in the book, but I think captures the idea of the book pretty well. And that is, inequality is a little bit like blood pressure. It is something which can be too low. If your blood pressure is too low, it's you're sluggish. That's a sign you're not going to be performing very well. Inequality, blood pressure of zero, like inequality of zero, would be a ticket to the cemetery. Then there's a normal range, and low normal to high normal, but a range in which the system is functioning reasonably well. Then one has to ask what happens when the measure goes up and it spikes, and your blood pressure spikes or your inequality measure spikes. And my argument is that's a sign that you're heading for trouble. in both cases. So if you look through that prism, and I think you've captured the meaning of inequality and its relationship to instability pretty well.
And where's our blood pressure reading right now in America?
Well, it went up dramatically in 1990, in the late 1990s, peaked in 2000, then it chopped up and down through the 2000s. It was going up in 2007, 2008, and guess what? We had the heart attack. It was called the Great Financial Crisis. Right? Now, mm-hmm. what happens afterwards, and these measures are very closely related to what happens in the stock market to prices of capital assets, is that it comes down afterwards and then goes up again when the stock market prices go up again. The event, the critical event that was foretold, if you like, by rising inequality was the Great Financial Crisis.
And it's foretold, and why? How is it foretold by that? I mean, is it a correlation or is there a causal relation?
I'm careful about claiming causal relationships here. Mm-hmm. What you're seeing in the inequality measure is the incomes reported in tax records of the wealthiest people in the country. You have to ask, who are they? Well, to begin with, they're bankers. We're talking about small numbers of people in the financial sector who are reporting very high incomes as a result of what? The fees their companies are earning on mortgage securitizations. I mean, if you think about it in concrete terms, then the link between the thing we're measuring is inequality and the thing that we know played an important role in the financial crisis is very clear. Again, if you look at in the late 1990s, the incomes are once again bankers plus the entrepreneurs and the corporate executives in information technology. Their incomes went up enormously as a result of stock options realizations and so forth. But this was a boom that would and did lead to a bust.
Our guest today, Professor James Galbraith, author of the new book, Inequality and Instability, just published by Oxford University Press. This is a live version of Media Matters. We're coming to you from WILL AM 580, so the phone lines are open at 217-333-9455 or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Galbraith, you know, I read a lot in the news media and in the business press and in academic scholarship about how, you know, the overwhelming majority of income gains over the last few decades have gone to a very small percentage of the population. And what's striking when I read your book and a couple of points in your research was another way to look at it is how almost all the income growth and economic inequality is accounted for by only 15 counties in the entire country. And if you take them out, we haven't had any change really in three decades. Could you explain that?
This was a little experiment that we did on the period of the late 1990s, and we had a measurement of inequality between counties. This is not all of the inequality that's in the data, but the inequality that is measured between average county incomes. So you're looking over 3,150 counties, and you're picking up a great deal of the movement of inequality as a whole that way. So you're asking, where are the incomes actually being booked? Then you can do the following experiment. Suppose you take one county, New York County, New York, out of the data in the sense that you say, well, what would have happened if starting in 1990 its income had grown at the average rate for the country rather than the actual rate? The total increase in inequality goes down by about 30%. If you take maybe 20%, if you take out four more counties, which would be three in Silicon Valley, California, San Mateo, San Clara, and San Francisco County, and one in Washington State, King County, which is Seattle and Microsoft and so forth, then about half of the rise in inequality goes away. And take out 10 more and it all goes away. So you're looking at what it tells you is that the rise in inequality, which we know was concentrated basically an increase in incomes of this very small number of people, that this small number of people were living in a very small part of the country, a few geographic spaces, and that they were working in a very small part of the economy, which, again, corresponds to what I think people understand from general experience and common sense, but it's a nice way of showing it with the available data.
So if we got rid of those 15 counties, it'd be a much more idyllic country. Is that the?
I don't know about that. It's just to say that that the.
No, I'm not recommending that. I'm just.
No, but I'm just saying the experience of. It's to say, first of all, the inequality in this period was very closely related to the information technology boom. Not just an abstract 1%. It's a very particular sector, and that, by the way, is not. It changes. In 2003, 2004, the big income earners are right around Washington, D.C. It's the military sector. And in 2007, you see a big spike in places like South Florida and Southern California as a result of the housing boom and bubble. So
high-tech per se wasn't a cause of it. It just was the lucky beneficiary of financial speculation?
I'm reluctant to use this word cause because what I'm doing here is illustrating in a very clear way what actually happened. And inequality is one way of taking the measure, one general way of taking the measure of what's going on in the economy.
But I guess another way to put it, just to clarify this, the more recent tech boom of the last 5 years with other companies, I don't know if you've studied the more recent data, but it doesn't necessarily lead to the same results. I mean, I don't know. Or do you know?
Well, we can bring the data up to within a year or two of the present. It's an ongoing project to keep current.
Okay. Our guest, James Galbraith, author of the new book, Inequality and Instability. Professor Galbraith, you studied the world. There's just extraordinarily comprehensive study for many years. What role do labor unions play in the question of economic inequality in a society? And I ask that for the, I think, self-evident reason for people who are my age or older, that one of the striking developments of the last 30 or 40 years in the United States has been, the virtual collapse of labor unions in the private sector to where they play a negligible role compared to being fairly prominent, in the 1960s and 70s.
Well, labor unions were, of course, much more prominent when the manufacturing sector was a much larger piece of the American economy. We've hardly added any manufacturing jobs since the 50s. Almost everything that every new job we've added has been in the services sector, much, much harder to organize. At sectors where there were less, less ability for labor unions to really influence the sharing of influence the level of wages. So that is certainly a big change in the political economy of the United States. Labor unions were much more important in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s than they have been since the Reagan era really put the squeeze on them in a big way. We do find, looking at other parts of the world, and particularly everybody focuses when you talk about trade unions on Northern Europe, that countries which were and have been strongly unionized tend to be, of course, much more egalitarian and much stronger social welfare systems. But there's also an interesting effect in smaller countries like Sweden of having a compact, compressed wage structure in that countries in that position tend to attract high productivity industries. They tend to attract strong industries that can pay high wages, and they tend to discourage industries that require low wages in order to survive, in other words, the bottom-feeding parts of the industrial sector. And the effect of this in the smaller countries has been to raise their incomes relative to the rest of their immediate neighbors, and as a result, it's partly, I think, substantially because of that policy over a long period of time that the Scandinavian countries became so rich.
Our guest, James Galbraith, author of Inequality and Instability. The phone number here, 333-9455, area code 217, or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our toll-free line now. Spring Bay, Illinois, you're on the air with James Galbraith.
Good afternoon. That statistic you quoted about inequality with just a few counties in the country is, I think, absolutely amazing. 30% in New York City alone or New York County. I wanted to ask you a question. I've read this book, and I got it actually as a from contributing, to the show. It's called The Great Financial Crisis by John Bellamy Foster and Fred Magdoff. And my question is, do you know anything about these two economists, and what do you think of their work? And I'll get off and listen offline. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
Sorry, it's a short answer. No, I'm not familiar with the book.
Okay, well, that will go down as the shortest answer in the history of Media Matters in our 10 years, Professor Galbraith, so thank you for that. You know, onto the issue we were just talking about, the question of unions in Europe. One of the issues in the business press for the last two decades that I've been tracking, that you write about at some length in the book, is the notion that unemployment was higher in Europe because there was what's called labor market rigidity, which I think means basically unions got in the way of management being able to tell workers what to do and kept, you know, it cut into the prerogatives of management.
Correct.
The argument was that if Europe could get rid of that, then you would have more jobs, less unemployment, and workers would ultimately be much better off. Tell me if I'm correctly summarizing that position, and then after you've corrected my summary, tell me what your findings show.
And first of all, entirely correct. This has been and was up until the crisis a constant refrain of European politics. That the problem that Europe had was high unemployment. High unemployment was because it lacked flexibility. The cure was flexibilization. And that was essentially getting rid of the institutions of social democracy and the welfare state that had been built up in the war, since the war. And that, you know, you heard this all the time, and the great comparison was with the United States, which allegedly had very good employment experience, and the reason allegedly was that we have flexible labor markets, which permitted management to match pay to the requirements of technology. That's the basic story. Well, there are two ways of checking that story against the facts, and neither really had been done. The first was to look inside Europe and say, well, you know, there's a lot of differences inside Europe from north to south, really substantial differences in inequality. Is it true that the countries which have more inequality in their wage structures have better employment experience? I mean, you would expect that to be the case if the story were true. Turns out it's not the case at all. In fact, quite the contrary. The countries that have the most compressed wage structures, the most egalitarian, have by far the lowest unemployment, average unemployment rates over time. North Europe does much better than Southern Europe. And, you know, then you ask, I once actually at a luncheon asked the head of the European Central Bank for his view on this, and he said, oh, yes, well, the Scandinavians, they have a different model, but he couldn't explain what the model was. And the reality is that the theory was wrong. The theory was plainly wrong in that there are good reasons for an economist, even a very conventional one, thinking along the right lines, to expect that when you have much more inequality, you're going to have more unemployment. People are going to leave the bad jobs looking for the small number of much better jobs, and while they're hunting, and there are very few such jobs in an unequal society, they're going to be unemployed. And you can see this in the migration patterns that have overtaken the Chinese economy. It's a universal kind of phenomenon. So next question was, is it really true that the Europeans are more egalitarian than the United States in terms of their wage structures, which requires you being careful about what you're comparing with. You have to compare apples to apples. But when you do that, the issue turns on whether you count the difference between Germany and Poland, let's say, as part of your inequality measure, like whether you treat Europe as a series of individual countries with, you know, only local labor markets, or whether you treat it as a big continental economy, which in fact it is. And you can say, well, yes, the workers don't move all that much, but if you are a multinational corporation, it doesn't matter whether the workers move. You can move your factories to where the workers are, and you certainly can choose between locating a factory in Germany or locating it in Spain or Poland or someplace. So when you bring the whole European continent into focus, which is something that we can do with our particular the way we measured inequality, and you compare that continent to the United States, you discover that, in fact, the European labor markets are not more equal than the U.S. Yes, Denmark is more equal than the U.S., but Europe as a whole is not, because there are huge differences between the North and the South and between the East and the West. And in the United States, the differences that used to exist, for example, between the Old South and the industrial Midwest, have been narrowed dramatically in over 70 years since the New Deal, 50 years since the Great Society, by a whole series of policy measures which the Europeans have not implemented.
Professor Galbraith, one of the issues you raise, I think, in the discussion of Cuba, but I think it applies generally. I want to get to Cuba later, but for now, the following up in Europe, and it's something that I just want to know how you factor this into your research, is what I think economists sometimes call the social wage, meaning that in a country like Norway, for example, any worker, independent of their job, knows they will have health care, their children will get all education paid for, they'll have an old age pension, they don't have to worry about, you know, the sort of core things people stress out about economically are pretty much off the table, regardless of what your income is in the country. And how does that weigh into understanding inequality in a country?
I think it's an important corollary to having strong institutions generally. But I also want to be a little careful about the, I think it's a trap to compare the United States with 360 million people to Norway with 4 million people.
Well, that was more the principle I was talking
about.
A
great pool of offshore oil. I mean, these are very good things for the Norwegians, but they are a little bit special in the world. But yes, in general, having a fair and comprehensive scheme of social insurance is an important factor in the overall sense of equality in the society. And here, I'm going to say a word in favor of the United States, which I know is very unfashionable on the left. I think that the institutions that the United States has are, you know, they're not so bad. I think Social Security is hugely important and successful program to reduce, in fact, practically eliminate dire poverty amongst the elderly. I think Medicare is a very, very successful program. Medicaid is a successful program. And these institutions are, first of all, under threat. That's the real issue, one of the most important issues that we face, under threat for spurious economic reasons, and extremely worth defending as a political matter.
I don't think anyone on the left is going to argue with you on that point.
There is a tendency on the left to say that the U.S.'s social protections are greatly inferior to those in Europe. I'm skeptical of that argument. It's true that it's very good to have comprehensive health insurance that covers the whole population. That is an extremely important social gain that the Europeans have had. But when you weigh everything together, there are some other areas in which the U.S. actually does better than the Europeans. True, for example, of the quality of higher education in this country. I am inclined to say the U.S. has been and continues to be a fairly well-functioning middle-class society with important institutions that we tend to undervalue and that we really need to strongly speak up to defend.
By that logic, then, Professor Galbraith, I guess the pretty, enormous attacks going on against the very institutions you just said are the hallmark of something Americans should be proud of. It could threaten the quality of your argument if those institutions get wiped out or get diminished in any notable way.
Well, it certainly would change the circumstances, sure.
Yeah.
And that is the thing that I think we most need to avoid. What I worry about is that when the election is over and the great and the good come together and say, now we need to deal with our fiscal crisis, and we need to do that in the long term, which means we need to cut Social Security and Medicare, that progressive forces will not stand up and say no, that they will buy into the notion that these programs are already so weakened that they're not giving good value to the population. And the reality is that they are still extraordinarily important to the basic well-being of the American population, including the population that isn't elderly, because the existence of these programs relieves the burden of supporting the older population from their immediate families, spreads it out over the whole community, makes it much more bearable than it otherwise would be.
Offhand, it seems like the immediate threat that you're outlining comes much more from those Democratic Party politicians who are close to power or in power, who seem to be fairly willing to trade in that area, despite the fact their voting base is not sympathetic at all to that position.
Correct. That is exactly the issue, and that is why the base of the Democratic Party needs to be alert and needs to be sending out clear signals that it will not tolerate this kind of post-election betrayal of the core institutions that were created by the Democratic Party.
One of the things I really liked about your book, Professor Galbraith, was you have chapters on different countries around the world. And usually when we hear the talk about inequality, as you know, you get the United States, you get Europe, you get an occasional third world country thrown in to scare us all to death. But you have, I think, a really interesting discussion of two countries, China and Cuba, that I wasn't exactly expecting when I picked up the book. And let's just start with China. Why is China in the book, and what are the lessons of China?
Well, China is the largest country in the world, and it belongs in any book that tries to deal with this issue. China has experienced an enormous increase in inequality as a result of the rise of the coastal cities and of and also to some degree of the liberalization of its economy and the rise of a powerful financial sector inside China. This has created for China an enormous destabilization of the population, which is to say enormous migration from the countryside to the cities, not only of people coming permanently, but also of people who are moving back and forth. And that is probably the most important source of social tensions in China, the most important development issue that the Chinese are obliged to deal with. So I think by studying the Chinese economy, and first of all, you learn something that's intrinsically of interest, and you learn, of course, also that it's possible to get information that's quite interesting and very apparently reliable. That tells you a great deal about what's going on in this, as I say, large and important country. Cuba's a different sort of case. Cuba is a small, well, not so small, it's a large island, but as islands go, I mean, as countries go, it's quite small, nearby country that has been certainly cut off from the United States and, in part isolated from the larger the larger capitalist world in the event for quite a long time. And so it's quite interesting to ask, okay, what can we find out about what's been happening in Cuba, particularly in a moment of extraordinary stress? Its major patron, the Soviet Union, collapsed in 1991. Cuba's export trades collapsed. Its subsidies, its subsidized sources of energy went away. It went through an enormous adjustment to that and then gradually was able to not entirely, but to substantially restructure and deal with the consequences. Unlike practically any other socialist regime, the Cuban regime did not fall.
Yeah, offhand, and it's not part of your book, but why is that? Why did Cuba survive when all the other communist countries collapsed under what are incredible circumstances?
Under extremely difficult circumstances, but I think there are two reasons. First of all, the Cuban Revolution was not like the occupation of Eastern Europe. It was not, in fact, like the Bolshevik Revolution. It was not the work of a small coterie. It was a very widely supported popular event in which internal legitimacy was reinforced over time by two things. First of all, the departure to the United States of a lot of people who opposed it, and secondly, the isolation and the kind of self-reliance of those who remained. So if you go to Cuba, the atmosphere even today is really quite different from what it was in, let's say, Czechoslovakia in the 60s and 70s, when you were in a country whose government had been put in place by a foreign power. This was not true of Cuba. And secondly, the Cuban regime had emphasized social and human development, and its record on that front by any standard is quite remarkable. Has very good life expectancy, very strong medical care, very substantially widespread high educational standards. And the result of that, I think, is a population which is has a lot of cohesion to it. So it's a very interesting place. It's going to be very interesting to see how Cuba navigates the current wave of economic reforms, of modest opening up, and the future. It's extremely interesting to ask how this enormous island in the Caribbean, very large relative to the rest of the Caribbean, is going to influence the economy of that region as it becomes more and more, particularly open to the United States.
Let's go to our phone lines now to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with James Galbraith.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to maybe the media end of this, and there's a litany that you've been going through about how wrong people understand things, this misapprehension of income structure, for one. And it reminds me of something that's been commented on a number of times, this Pew study, that if you anonymize income structures, even Republicans like the Swedish income distribution, compact and high wage. So one uncommented part of that was that economists were also polled, and they have a majority of them have a total misapprehension of the actual income distribution in this country. They think it's much rosier than it is. So I wanted you to talk about how these erroneous opinions are constructed, and I also wanted to specifically, the last time I checked, the Peterson Institute and the Peterson Foundations were contributing about $1 million to various projects to sort of construct and push the austerity model from years ago, and they've just got their name on this rather ridiculous Niall Ferguson documentary on PBS called Civilization, the West and the Rest, which justifies empire and all sorts of ludicrous things. But the Peterson fingerprints are on that as well. He's not an economist, but he's saying a lot about why we are where we are. And I just wanted to know why we are where we are, this total confusion. Even the deficit, the long-term debt of the U.S. is versus GDP isn't as frightening as that's heretical to say, but I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. James Galbraith, there's a lot there to chew on. Anything you want to talk about?
Well, let's not get me started on Peter G. Peterson, who was the Commerce Secretary under Richard Nixon and has been for many decades energetic opponent of all the stabilizing institutions of the New Deal and the Great Societies, particularly Social Security, has been, in my view, has done an enormous amount of damage in attempts to propagandize the public in a way which I can only wish him the most abject failure going forward. Question. Let me just touch on the issue of the public debt and the deficit of the United States. Again, the reality is that the United States government does not have a financing problem. It has a large gap by historical standards, between what the government takes in tax revenues and what it lays and its outlays and expenditure, when it spends. Reserve balances are created in the banking system, and the banking system likes to convert those reserve balances into treasury bonds on which it can earn some interest. So the demand for treasuries is not something which is independent of the size of the deficit. It's basically brought about by the deficit. And for that reason, since the United States government is never going to default on its debts unless Congress does something extraordinarily stupid, which I think the Congress will not do, United States government, the Treasury, never has a problem placing its bonds. It's always responding to a prior demand by banks and other investors to have an asset that earns interest. This is just, to turn this into some problem is to imagine that the United States has to go out and find money on the open market in order to fund its activity. That was true when governments were basically operating with gold and silver coins, but it is not true in the modern world and has not been true in the United States since, I mean, there hasn't even been legal institutions that even approximated that since the early 1970s. So we need to recognize that we live in a world in which public finances of large countries like ours are basically managed, and the U.S. is in a very special case condition in which the rest of the world, for whatever reasons, likes to hold U.S. Treasury bonds. Basically, because we're a large country, there are a lot of these bonds. They're very liquid, easily turned into cash in any currency you might like. And so the Bank of Japan and the People's Bank of China and others are quite happy to pile up large balances that are held basically at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And they aren't going to stop doing that. So long as they do, the U.S. government is going to be supplying those bonds, which means it's going to be running a budget deficit to that extent. This is now normal activity. We should not allow people who are intent on other purposes to use it to propagandize or cause anxiety in the broader public.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We have a couple of Walt callers who have been waiting patiently, both from Urbana. Let's start with line two. Urbana, you're on the air with Professor Galbraith.
Columnist George Will wrote a column regarding the defense budget, and he quotes two senators saying that the defense budget is no longer auditable or verifiable, and they spend like $650 billion a year, which is about $1.6 billion a day. And I'll hang up and listen.
The answer is yes. This is true. I'm involved with, I've been the chair of the board of an organization called Economists for Peace and Security for quite a few years now, that a group of people that have a professional interest in these issues. I think there is something to be said for a world in which one large country with that commands the respect of the rest of the world and doesn't have an overbearing use of its power provides the major military force in the world, discourages everybody else from spending a lot of money on this, and provides a security that everybody else basically can use. This is a good thing, but it needs to be done at the lowest cost for us. And there is an enormous amount that we spend in our military budget that is the result of bureaucratic planning going back decades. We are building a major new fighter aircraft, a couple of them actually, to defeat the Soviet Air Force. And it's simply preposterous to be doing this. It is not the case that you can spend, that if you double or triple the amount you spend on fighter aircraft, that you're going to get double or triple the performance. We have already basically exhausted years ago the what was available in terms of aerodynamic efficiency gains, and they're now just adding weight and electronic doodads to these machines. And it's very unlikely that they will be as functional as the ones we already have. So there is a good reason to take a very hard look at expenditures on the military that don't, in fact, add to our national security. There's also good reason to examine what remains of the military missions that we had to see what, in fact, they're actually accomplishing. At the same time, I think there's also a good reason to preserve the position of the United States as the as a provider of the service of global security. And I think the rest of the world, if we handle that job properly, the rest of the world probably continue to appreciate our doing that for the most part.
In the book, I just remember one reference you made, Professor Galbraith, to the notion of military Keynesianism, that military spending by the federal government can be used to sort of prop up a more stagnant economy and put money in the hands of workers, then we'll buy private sector products and all those good things that happen. That military Keynesianism is no longer as effective as it may have been in the past. Is that a fair summary of what
you're saying? Well, the military is, overall, I mean, you can say it's very, very large, as a caller indeed did, but it's, what, 5% of GDP. I'd have to look at the exact number. It is not 30% of GDP. It is not. We're in a world in which the private economy and the nonprofit sector and the state and local government sector and healthcare, education, and so on, you take all these things together, they're much larger than the military. And as a result, you can't expect military spending to be a dominant force on economic activity. Also, on those very unfortunate occasions when we actually go to war, we do so with, by historical standards, very small numbers of people. And so when you look at the economic effects, for example, of the war in Iraq, they basically added a percent and a half to GDP for a few quarters in 2003. That was it. And if you look at where those expenditures had an effect, you look, they have 20, maybe 15 counties around Washington, D.C., where the effects show up strongly. And the rest of the country is extremely hard to find them. It is much smaller now than it even was in the time of Vietnam, let alone Korea or World War II. In World War II, it was 25% it was actually 100% of previously existing output by the time of the end of the war.
We've got time for our one final caller. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the earth, Professor James Galbraith.
Yes, I have a question. Hopefully you maybe have some statistics on this or could hazard a guess. But if you were to compare the average income of the 1%, let's say the very wealthy, say from the mid-60s, mid-70s, in today's dollars, what would those people have earned at that time? I mean, now you have to earn tens, hundreds of millions of dollars to be in that level. But in the 1960s, what did you have to earn to be considered very wealthy?
Excellent question, to which I do not have an answer off the top of my head. A big difference between the 60s and 70s and the present has to do with what corporate executives make. And there, the differential between the very small number of top corporate executives and their average workers has gone up probably by a factor of 10, from 40 times to 400 times. That's a rough guess. What's going on there is that the corporation has become a vehicle for channeling capital income, stock options in particular, to its top executives. I see that. You know, it's partly a distributional question. Should people running big organizations really be accumulating that much wealth? But it's also partly a question of the effects on the functioning of the organization. When you have a corporate executive who's primarily concerned with piling up a vast stock of personal financial wealth, that person is not going to be as tied to the long-term performance of their company as was the case back in the 60s and 70s. And we see the result in what's happened to the great American corporations, which have become, in many cases, gone into crisis and often disappeared, either flirted with bankruptcy or gone into it, and have lost the position that they held in the economy compared to banking institutions, which have become much more powerful now than they were then.
Professor Galbraith, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means our hour has gone by quickly, and we have to kill her out of the studio. James Galbraith, author of the new book, Inequality and Instability, just published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for taking time out of your Sunday to join us here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's been a lot of fun. I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, Christina Williams, my producer, for joining me and making today's show possible. And we will be back in 167 hours with Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist and the Princeton University economist, talking about his new book and talking about whether we're in a depression, and if we are, what can be done and what isn't being done right now to prevent it. It should be a wonderful show. Until then, everyone, have a great week. I'm Bob McChesney. Happy summer.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, AM 580 and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. Turning to weather, sunny today with a high near 80 degrees, wind gusts to the west between 6 and 11 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 16 miles per hour. Mostly cloudy this evening with low around 60, a chance of showers and thunderstorms by Monday, partly sunny with a high near 80, and